Joining us on Counterfire today is Kate Hudson, who is here to talk to us about why Cameron feels the need to be spending £100 billion to replace Trident. That demonstration will be taking place on the 27th, so I hope everyone will be there. And Kate, why is it that Cameron feels the need to spend so much money on nuclear weapons?
Well, that's a very good question, Yasmin. And can I just start off by saying you've used that £100 billion figure, and we have used that ourselves. But recent information shows that even government and parliament recognise it will cost a lot more than that. I think current estimates are that it could cost as much as £183 billion to replace the Trident system. So we're talking about a massive amount of money. Cameron's really got a job on explaining why he thinks that's necessary. And interestingly, if you look at his own government's national security strategy, which was published at the end of last year, state-on-state nuclear stuff has been downgraded by this government, the previous government, to a Tier 2 threat. So Tier 1 threats are things like climate change, cyber warfare, terrorism, pandemics, you know, all those things that we recognise as serious stuff, serious 21st century problems. But he's wanting to spend, as you say, this vast amount of money on what's a 20th century system, pretty redundant system that nowadays experts are saying, well, actually it could come under cyber attack, it could be disabled by cyber attack, it could be detected by underwater drones and knocked out, you know. So
it's clearly been built into our archaic system that we need such harmful weapons in order to maintain our powerful position within this world. And they'll never even be used, will they?
We hope not, because if they are, we won't be here. But I think the reason why, I mean, it's an interesting question, because military people say it's militarily useless, it should be scrapped, we want to spend it on things we can actually use, you know, troops, boots and all that kind of thing. It's an interesting insight in Tony Blair's autobiography, and he said, he was referring back to when there was the big debate in Parliament in 2007 about whether to start the process of replacement, and he said, well, I looked at both sides of the argument and there was a good case either way. I could have gone for or against. And he said, in the end, I decided to go down the yes, replace route because of our standing in the world. It would be too much of a blow to our national status not to have nuclear weapons. So, and I think for many of them, it's that. They talk about our role in the world, Britain's seat at the top table and all that, as if you have to have vastly expensive weapons of mass destruction in order to have a role in the world, you know.
So Cameron says that Corbyn can't be trusted with our national security for his views against using Trident. Is this a way to scare the public into believing that?
I would be scared. Well, I am scared having a Prime Minister who would even be willing to destroy the world by pressing the nuclear button. I mean, to me, Jeremy Corbyn just talks good sense on this. You know, he would not be willing to destroy us all. Good. As far as I'm concerned, that's good. And in actual fact, I think that Jeremy Corbyn has got a much better approach to Britain's security, you know, which is actually not just going for the guns or, you know, going for a military option, but looking to see how we can resolve the problems that we face or other global problems, regional problems, how you get to the root of what's caused those and how you resolve them. You know, so the wars in the Middle East, you know, you have to look back at what originally caused those, role of British imperialism, other countries' colonial intentions and activities and so on, then, you know, the quest for oil, all those kinds of factors come into play. And you have to resolve those through diplomatic and political initiatives. You know, there have to be political solutions to these things, not war and intervention, nuclear weapons and all that. So I would trust Jeremy Corbyn to bring about peaceful solutions, follow good ways of trying to resolve serious global problems.
So there's clearly a split in Labour at the moment, particularly regarding issues such as this one. What do you think Corbyn's election as Labour leader tells us about the future of the Labour Party?
How I see it, Blair was elected on a roll in 1997. People were sick of the Tories and all that kind of thing. And his support for the Labour Party under his leadership declined steadily throughout his period in office. You know, so he had a big majority decline because of things that he did wrong. I mean, you know, the Labour government achieved many good things and was obviously much better than Tories, but he took us into an illegal war, which was devastating for his leadership. You know, then they went down the privatisation route and, you know, the kind of austerity thing eventually, you know. So all that kind of thing was, those were political problems. And to the extent that many people couldn't be bothered to vote Labour in the last election. So the Tories had a historic low vote, but they won because people didn't have any confidence that Labour was going to solve the problems. So then you have the leadership campaign, and Jeremy comes through because he is genuinely popular. And there's a huge surge of support for his leadership in the Labour Party, and now a huge surge of support for the Labour Party as a result. So the kind of useless Blairism, you know, people who couldn't even win an election against Tories, as far as I'm concerned, it's not a split in the Labour Party. They're sort of, they should be on the way out. That's what people have to recognise. They don't represent what Labour is. And what Labour is and what people want Labour to be is represented by Corbyn and the massive surge towards him. That's the future for the Labour Party, if they can stick to their, you know, stick on that track and fight for ordinary people.
And also, what's the legality of holding trident or nuclear weapons?
It's not illegal to possess nuclear weapons, although there's a huge international effort being made by over 100 states, you know, states, not campaigns, you know, actual countries at the UN, to introduce a ban treaty which would make nuclear weapons illegal in the same way that chemical and biological weapons are illegal. So it's an anomaly at the moment. It's not illegal to have them. It would be illegal to use them because of what they would do. So because they're indiscriminate, you know, they're weapons of mass destruction, the use of those types of weapons is illegal, you know, because it's only legal to use weapons if you can be sure that you're targeting military personnel, not civilians, right? So obviously. Plus, it's illegal to cause that kind of environmental damage and all that sort of thing. It's against the Geneva Convention. It's illegal to use. It's also illegal under international law for countries that don't already have them to get, if they are signed up to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
So on a global level, replacing our trident, what does this mean for other countries? I imagine they'd perceive it more of a threat to then want to get their own.
Well, it's quite an interesting thing. I mean, because you mentioned the legal thing. We actually, and the other nuclear weapons states, are legally required to disarm. And there's quite a strong legal case against replacing Trident. Because under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which we are a signatory, as well as countries who don't have them not getting them, the countries that do have them have signed up to say they'll get rid of them. So if we get a whole new system that is completely at odds with our legal commitment under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, it's actually under international treaty law illegal to replace Trident. But I mean, our politicians seem to be immune to legal arguments, as far as I can see. It's quite interesting because the countries, the other 192 or whatever it is, countries in the world that don't have them, are thoroughly sick of the small number of nuclear weapons states not getting rid of them, because they're all at risk, you know, because if there's a nuclear war, you know, by accident even or intention. So they're pretty angry. So that's what's behind the initiative towards a ban before. But interestingly, there's another legal initiative from the Marshall Islands. This is going to hit the news in the near future, because the Marshall Islands, you know, in the Pacific, they were victims of nuclear weapons testing, but over 60 nuclear weapons tests were carried out on their islands. You know, many of them, or some of them, 1,000 times the power of the Hiroshima bomb. So you can imagine the impact that that's had on those islands, some of them being completely destroyed, the radiation impact on the population.
And it still has an impact, doesn't
it? Well, for successive generations, of course. So it's terrible. So they, the little Marshall Islands, have gone to the International Court of Justice with a legal case against all the nuclear weapons states for not complying with their obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Cooperation Treaty. Some countries it doesn't really affect because they don't recognise the ICJ, the Court, International Court of Justice, but Britain does recognise the ICJ. So this kind of case is coming up now against Britain, so it'll be interesting to see how the government responds to it. And of course the danger is, as I think you hinted in your question, if we carry on saying we need nuclear weapons for our security, other countries will come to the same conclusion.
How long do you think politicians are going to keep brushing away what really is the truth, just to hold on to that power? I mean, obviously, it's very built into our archaic sort of system.
That's an interesting one, because attitudes have changed a huge amount over the last, let's say, decade, not just in Britain. And there was quite a few global initiatives around this, not just it was in the United States about a decade ago. Henry Kissinger, remember, as a real Cold Warrior, you know, he actually came out and said, alongside other, you know, quite senior retired US diplomats and politicians and so on, that the world was now too dangerous to have nuclear weapons, you know, because maybe during the Cold War you had two, you know, relatively stable countries at a standoff. I mean, I don't agree with his analysis, like it was nutty then. But, you know, now in a very different world with terrorism and all that kind of thing, if you have more and more nuclear proliferation, you're going to end up where they are used. You know, so he and many people like him think that the world is now too dangerous with asymmetrical war. Britain, for example, as I mentioned earlier, but people recognise that it is it's like a totem, you know, a kind of thing about power and status that is redundant. And more people recognise that all the technological problems, the dangers posed to it, as well as the dangers it can pose to us. And then, of course, there's all the arguments about other things we could spend it on, not just other military stuff, you know, about investing in the economy, sustainable energy production, for example, or then there's social spending on hospitals and education. No good reason for having nuclear weapons. And I think even the people who say, oh, we have to have it, it's a deterrent and all that kind of thing, that basically means you base our national security on a will they, won't they, press the button kind of game of bluff. You know, and what sane and rational person is going to base national security on a game of bluff? Attitudes are changing overall. The majority of the polls show a majority against. So, you know, attitudes have shifted.
And do you think that protests, the amount of protests we've had against nuclear weapons, have pushed public to see more of the truth behind what's going on? And do you think it's a really important way of swaying public opinion and also bringing the topic into the media as well?
Yeah, I think mass protest is a very important part of the range of ways in which we participate in our democracy as citizens to show what we think. Mm. You know, a demonstration is exactly that. It's a demonstration of a mass opinion about something. You know, we don't just go out there for exercise or to be cross. We are collectively saying, look, we think this is a bad idea, we don't want you to do it. And that goes alongside local campaigning work, you know, because C&D and other groups do a lot of local street work and petitioning and vigils and all kinds of things like that. A lot of lobbying of MPs, writing to MPs, visiting them at their surgeries to discuss the issue. There's all kinds of ways in which people can get involved. I mean, including C&D, of course, has a long tradition of non-violent direct action, so going to the bases, going to Aldermaston, Burfield, where the weapons are made, you know, actually confronting the problem at its source, you know, as well as in the political arena. So I think, yeah, popular protest is extremely important, particularly at this time, because the demonstration, 27th of February, is timed to come before Parliament makes its decision. So it's not just a random date. The earliest date we are aware that the government might put it to Parliament is in March. So it's there to just gee up the MPs. I mean, there will be many MPs on the demonstration, by the way, supporting it. You know, a lot of them are against. But it's a way of consolidating that message, you know, as they go to vote in the next weeks or months.